Welcome, everyone. So it's great pleasure to have Lisa Drummond from MIT to give the strong faculty seminar today. So Lisa has been working on the dynamics of extreme mass ratio in spirals, and today she will talk about specifically the spin dynamics, I think. Yeah, Lisa, please attend.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yes. Yeah. So hi, everyone. I'm a PhD student at MIT. As was mentioned, I'll be talking about spinning secondary effects in Emery's. So probably many of you are already familiar with Emery's, which are extreme mass ratio in spirals and sources of gravitational wave signals. But just to provide a bit of background, I'll sort of briefly discuss what Emery's are and why they're interesting and why we might care about them. Let me see if I can change a slide. Okay, right. So Emery's, as the name suggests, consists of a binary black hole system with a very extreme mass ratio. So sort of a canonical Emery would be a stellar mass black hole in a binary with a supermassive black hole in the center of a galaxy. So I'm going to play you this video. Hopefully that sound isn't too annoying, which shows sort of an Emery in spiraling, emitting gravitational waves. And essentially the cyan curves here are showing the trajectory of the smaller black hole plunging into this large central body, which is, you know, canonically going to be a supermassive black hole. Okay, so that's an Emery. Now, why do we care about Emerys? They're very unique and special systems due to the fact that they have this very large mass ratio. And this means that we see, or we will see, thousands to millions of orbits before they eventually merge. And these signals will remain in the band of like gravitational wave detectors that we'll have in the future. Because we see this very long duration signal, this will enable really precise measurement of properties of the black hole, in particular the larger black hole, because we'll be able to probe the space-time around that black hole in really great detail. So for example, we'll be able to infer properties such as the mass and spin very precisely. We'll also be able to learn things about the geometry of the system, the orbital geometry of the system, I mean. And we'll be able to infer potentially relatively precisely. So what does this mean? What kind of science can we do with these precise measurements? Well, of course, we can test theories of gravity, which is something I think many of you care about in this room. We'll also be able to learn about sort of the astrophysics of supermassive black holes, like their formation channels, you know, how these systems came to be. We'll be able to learn about, you know, the dense, you know, galactic nucleus and the environment around supermassive black holes. Finally, potentially we can even do cosmology with these systems, particularly if we're able to get more precise distances and localizations with these higher precision gravitational wave measurements. Okay. Right, so hopefully I've explained to you why Emery's are of astrophysical importance. They're systems that we're likely to observe with future gravitational wave detectors, and we can do lots of cool science with them, and we can do it hopefully very precisely. But another sort of complementary aspect is more sort of from a fundamental theoretical perspective. Emery's represent this really nice, clean limit of the relativistic two-body problem. And as we all know, the relativistic two-body problem is non-trivial. You know, when we solve it numerically, it can be extremely challenging. So looking at the two-body problem through this nice, clean lens of this extreme mass ratio limit might potentially shed light on the more general two-body problem and might be a powerful tool for building more general models of gravitational wave systems, which hopefully I'll be able to talk about at the end of this presentation. Okay. Right. So just again, to set the background, I'm sure many of you know this, but what kind of detectors will we use to observe EMRIs? We can't observe EMRIs with current ground-based gravitational wave detectors. The arms are not sufficiently long, and also there's seismic noise limitations, which limit sort of, the frequencies which we need for EMRIs. So this is one of the motivations for future space-based detector LISA, which is the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, and will be launched into space and have this equilateral triangle configuration with extremely long 2.5 million kilometer arms. And this is sort of like a 10-year in the future kind of project. So maybe 2034 or a little bit later is when LISA will hopefully launch. Okay. So with LISA, we can observe millihertz signals, which is what we want to see gravitational waves from EMRI. So it'll be sensitive to exactly the right kind of regime for these long duration EMRI, roughly millihertz kind of signals. So here I'm just showing you just, you know, for those of you who are super familiar with sort of the LIGO sensitivity bucket, I'm just giving you a comparison for where the LISA sensitivity curve will likely sit. So it won't be as sensitive. So it will detect much louder gravitational waves than LIGO. It will also be sensitive to a much lower frequency range, which is sort of exactly what we need for gravitational wave signals from like supermassive black holes. Okay. All right. So just to give you a more global picture, zooming out from specifically EMRIs, LISA will be able to detect a rich, diverse range of different gravitational wave sources. So for example, So for example, it'll be sensitive to supermassive black hole binary coalescences. It should see a few of those. So these numbers here are showing sort of estimates for how many LISA might see, while it's flying. So like of order 10, supermassive black hole binaries. We'll also be able to see sort of LIGO type binaries much earlier in the in spiral when they're lower in frequency. And, you know, again, of order 1 to 10 sort of range. Now, one of the largest sources, or the largest number of sources that LISA will detect, will be these galactic binaries. So, for example, white dwarf binaries in the galaxy. And there'll be an enormous number of these, which LISA will see. So of order 1,000 to 10,000. So yeah, this will be a huge sort of gravitational wave foreground. In addition, there'll of course be an unresolved population, which won't quite have the sensitivity to be able to be resolved by LISA, but will still contribute to the strain, in that frequency range. And finally, the sources which I'm most interested in are these extreme mass ratio in spirals. And the kind of range which we expect LISA to see isn't super well understood. So there's quite a large range, as you can see here. It basically depends on the most likely formation channels for EMRIs and, you know, various other factors which are not super well constrained at the moment. But we expect to see something in the range of 1 to 1,000 EMRIs with LISA. But I'll just make a comment that even with one EMRI, we can do a lot of amazing science and a lot of precision gravitational wave testing with like a single long duration EMRI signal. Okay. So now I'll motivate sort of why it's important to build the theoretical models which I've focused on during my PhD. And one of the motivations is that it's quite hard to detect emrys. So for example, I'm presenting to you here a cartoon of like a canonical LIGO black hole binary signal. This is obviously oversimplified, but typically you'll only see one black hole binary signal at a time in LIGO. There'll be some instrumental noise, and I'm obviously, I'm oversimplifying things because as we move into the next generation of gravitational wave detectors, we'll see many, many more signals, and this will become much more complicated. There are also things like glitches, which can complicate things. But, for the most part, we can usually, identify a single gravitational wave source at a given time in LIGO. With LISA, this will definitively not be the case. There'll be many, many sources all at the same time overlapping in the band. So as I mentioned, massive black hole binaries are a very large, source, which will contribute in the LISA band. So, and they're quite likely to have high signal to noise ratios and really dominate the power that we see. In addition, you'll have these, millions of galactic white dwarf binaries, which will, strongly color the signals that LISA see and create this sort of confusion noise. Then we'll, of course, have instrumental noise, naturally. And buried underneath both the instrumental noise and this gravitational wave foreground, we'll have an emery signal. Right, so basically this emery signal will be an order of magnitude below the other sources that LISA will see, and also below the instrumental noise intrinsic to the LISA instrument. But the advantage of emery signals is, of course, that they're extremely long-lived and they remain in band for a very long period of time, which means that signal-to-noise ratio can be built up as we observe them. And kind of analogous to continuous wave sources in LIGO, for example. So essentially we have a needle in a haystack. So the emery source is like this little needle buried underneath all of the instrumental noise and the other gravitational wave sources. And perturbation theory, black hole perturbation theory, which is the tool that I've used throughout my PhD, enables us to build precise and also tractable and fast models, which will be able to stay in phase over this very long duration emery signal, meaning that we can build up enough noise for the emery signal to be not just detectable, but for us to do really cool and interesting science with it. So the plan is that LISA will launch in the 2030s, maybe the late 2030s, and we need to have these perturbation theory waveforms developed by then. This is a considerable challenge. So people have been working on this extreme mass limit of the two-body problem for many years, decades, but there's been a considerable amount of progress recently in particular, which I'll talk to you a little bit about. We're kind of on track for having these models ready for the launch of LISA, I think. Okay. All right, so why is perturbation theory suitable for emrys? I mean, this is kind of maybe very natural. It's exactly what you would expect, but essentially, it's going to be very challenging to simulate these systems using, fully numerical relativity from start to finish, integrating over these hundreds of thousands of cycles, and also resolving the very disparate length scales in the system. Instead, these systems will very naturally lend themselves to be modeled using perturbation theory, because you have a very small system which perturbs the background space-time associated with the larger black hole. So you can very naturally perform perturbation theory in the mass ratio of the system. And this is black hole perturbation theory. It's essentially performing, you know, first and second order corrections to the geodesic solution associated with a Kerr black hole, because you have this very large black hole that dominates the background space-time and is governed by the Kerr metric. And so we perform perturbations to this in order to incorporate this secondary body. Okay. All right. So the very first correction, which one needs to think about, is gravitational self-force. So, of course, the secondary black hole, the smaller black hole, will have a gravitational field associated with it. It will dimple the space-time around it, and this will then back react on the motion of the small body. This is called gravitational self-force, and it's, you know, analogous to electromagnetic self-force. You know, it's exactly the same kind of principle, but, you know, in general relativity. Okay. Now, what I've primarily focused on in my PhD is the spin of that small black hole. So a geodesic will describe basically a test body that has no extended structure. It has no spin. It has no self-gravitational field. But of course, this doesn't really describe a real astrophysical black hole. Real astrophysical black holes will have spin, and this needs to be included into our gravitational wave models. And so these types of effects are called spinning secondary effects, including spin curvature force, for example, which I'll describe in more detail and present the mathematical equations for in a second. So these are essentially the two corrections which a black hole perturbation theorist needs to think about when constructing an Emery gravitational wave model. Gravitational self-force, which is the dimpling of the space-time around that small body, and spin curvature force, or secondary spin effects associated with the spin of that smaller black hole. And we have to include both of these effects in order to have sufficiently accurate models for LISA data analysis. In order to achieve all of that precision, wonderful astrophysics and fundamental physics that I mentioned at the start, we need to build these sufficiently precise Emery models with perturbation theory. Okay. So now I'll talk a little bit about secondary spin effects in particular. So secondary spin contributes to the gravitational wave phase. So this is where it shows up in the waveform model. You have, okay, so now I'll use my cursor, hopefully you can see. So you have first the adiabatic contribution, which is the leading order orbit averaged self-force contribution. And then at next order, you have these 1PA or post-1 adiabatic effects, essentially. And they consist of, you know, various gravitational wave self-force effects, as well as secondary spin effects. So I'm going to focus on these secondary spin effects. The gravitational self-force effects are also very important, of course, but I've focused on the spin effects in my research. Okay, so essentially to compute all of these secondary spin effects, you just need to complete this flowchart. And I've sort of pieced together various aspects of this calculation throughout my PhD, and I'm going to step through it bit by bit in this talk. Okay. So up the top, you have effects associated with spin curvature force. So these are conservative contributions to the motion, and they perturb the frequencies associated with spinning body orbits. So just to give you more of a heuristic picture, obviously at leading order you have, or at lowest possible order, you have the geodesic equations, where there's no spin of the small body, of course. when you include the spin of the small body, you have an effect called spin curvature force, which, as the name suggests, is the coupling between the spin of the small body and the curvature of the background space-time associated with the larger black hole. Okay, so I'm just going to present the equations to you so you can see them in a little more detail. So you might be familiar with these equations already. They're called the Matheson-Papapetrou-Dixon equations, and they are essentially like a multipole expansion describing, you know, the extended structure of that smaller body. So this is the pole-dipole form of the Matheson-Papapetrou-Dixon equations, and it includes spin curvature force effects. So you have a coupling between the Riemann tensor of the background spacetime and the spin tensor, this capital S here, which is associated with the secondary body. And this leads to spin curvature force, which basically just perturbs the motion, shifts the orbital frequencies, et cetera. You also have to describe the motion associated with the dynamics of the secondary spins vector and tensor. And you have to select a spin supplementary condition, which is essentially something like a gauge choice in order to close the system of equations. In the extreme mass ratio limit, we can take the leading order in spin version of these equations. So when I say leading order in spin, I mean leading order in secondary spin. These are exact in the primary black hole spin, of course. And they simplify dramatically, fortunately. And I can discuss in more detail about this if anyone's interested. But essentially, these are the systems of equations which I was interested in solving. And I was interested in not just solving them, but building precise and fast to compute, essentially semi-analytic models for describing the motion of a spinning body orbit. And I did this using a parameterization in terms of the orbital geometry or the turning points of the system. So, you know, essentially something like this, a Keplerian type description, which has a few extra corrections to account for the fact that you have spin of the small body. And the reason why this is nice is because we do need to describe completely generic orbits, because this is sort of what we expect astrophysically for Emery orbits. They can enter the Lisa band with large eccentricities potentially and, you know, inclinations. So parameterizing in terms of the orbital geometry provides a nice way of accounting for this. In addition, we use a frequency domain description, which allows for precise models of these trajectories. And so here you have, you know, the frequencies here are in terms of Meno time, which is, you know, convenient choice of time for the Kerr geometry, which you're probably aware of, where this epsilon s is the frequency associated with the precession of the spin vector. So all orbits can be decomposed into these into a frequency, a Fourier series with these three frequencies, which is very nice. Okay. So we describe these orbits precisely and you know, relatively fast to evaluate using this approach in these two papers here. Okay. Yep, I already discussed that. So the next step is to build on these precise models in order to evaluate the gravitational wave fluxes associated with each orbit, right? So, okay. I'll move on to my next slide. Okay, so in order to compute the gravitational wave flux associated with these orbits, you need to use the Dukolsky equation, which I've written schematically here. And for a point particle or for a test mass, you'll have, you know, a stress energy tensor that looks like this. But if you have a spinning particle, there's going to be an additional effect due to the dipole associated with that body. And this, you know, adds corrections to the gravitational wave flux, essentially. So what we do is we build on the framework which I developed in these two papers in order to compute the gravitational wave fluxes. And what we do is we can compute the change in energy and angular momentum associated with the horizon and infinity fluxes for, you know, a given spinning body orbit. And I did this work in collaboration with Victor and Georgos in Charles University in Prague. And the models that we developed are essential for astrophysically realistic systems, which have, you know, generic orbital geometries. And this is the first time that this calculation has been done for like a fully generic case. Okay, let me just check. Okay, I'm going okay for time. Okay, great. So just to give you a sense of how all of this fits together into, you know, a more global picture of what's been happening in the past few years in this spinning secondary field. Okay. As I mentioned, you have to combine the kinematics of the secondary black hole with the gravitational wave radiation, and you combine these two things together to compute the back reaction for any given orbit and construct a gravitational wave driven INSPIR. Of course, what you do is you start from the simplest possible type of orbit, which is, you know, a circular orbit, which is in the equatorial plane with the spins aligned. Then you move on to successively more complex orbital configurations. So just to give you a sense of what's been happening in the past 5 years, essentially, you know, 5 years ago, you had maybe this, hopefully you can see my cursor, maybe something like this portion of this table calculated. In the past roughly 5 years or so, we've, not just me, but many people in the perturbation theory community have managed to fill out this table. So it's almost complete. We've almost completely described spinning secondary effects for generic orbital configurations. So if you're at all interested, I recommend you check out all of these papers that I'm presenting here. However, the generic INSPIRAL, so the most complex case, including all of these different aspects for the most complex possible geometry, is still a work in progress. So essentially the work I've done during my PhD has been to achieve this goal. So as you can see, I've calculated, you know, descriptions of the orbital, of the orbits of a spinning body for a generic orbital configuration. I've computed the spinning secondary fluxes, and this is kind of the next step. You might think that having these two pieces already, the kinematics, so like each orbit for a given spin of a spinning secondary, and the gravitational wave radiation associated with this orbit, we can just naturally combine these two things and we obtain a gravitational wave driven INSPIRAL. However, there is one small technical challenge remaining, which is we know how the energy and angular momentum associated with a spinning body evolve, but the Carter constant is something which is a little more tricky to describe. So, you know, as I'm sure you all know, the Kerr space-time naturally has a Carter constant associated with it. A spinning body will also have a Carter-like constant associated with those bound orbits, but only to leading order and spin. And one of the remaining mathematical challenges is to describe how this evolves, you know, as gravitational radiation is emitted. So how this links to the horizon and infinity fluxes associated with gravitational wave emission. So hopefully that makes sense.
Lisa, do you mind if I interrupt and ask a question?
Of course, please.
There's a small piece of this that I'm missing, and I think I need your help with this. So if you don't deal with spin, then you're dealing with energy and angular momentum that are conserved quantities when the background motion is geodesic.
Exactly.
And you can use the fluxes to update these things under the emission of gravitational waves. But with the spin curvature force, you're not on a geodesic. Therefore, energy and angular momentum are not conserved. Yes. So how do you fill that little gap?
You're absolutely right. I didn't really describe this very well. But essentially, when I say E dot and JZ dot, I'm talking about a different definition of energy and angular momentum. So these are not the geodesic definitions. So basically, for any orbit under the influence of spin curvature force, you have two Killing vectors. So you'll have a natural definition of energy and angular momentum. And these are the definitions that I'm talking about here. So okay, these are not the geodesic.
You still have conserved quantities. I guess I didn't.
So they'll naturally be conserved quantities.
Happen after averaging over the precession time scale, or is it strictly?
Yes.
Okay, it's after averaging.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Right. So in addition, there's also a Carter-like constant, but this is a little trickier. It's only conserved to first order and secondary spin, not necessarily for any spinning body orbit to any order and spin. But this is something which people are actively working on at the moment, actually. So this is one of the remaining sort of mathematical and technical challenges. But I think we're very close. This is something that my collaborators are working on, I believe, right now. And soon, hopefully, we'll have a fully generic spinning body in spiral for an MRE. Okay. In the meantime, one of the questions which I'm interested in asking is, how does the in spiral change if you just consider the spin curvature force? So if you just consider the effect of the shifts in orbital frequency due to spin curvature force and how they change the gravitational wave signal, are these detectable? Are these measurable effects? This is one of the questions I was interested in asking. So as a first step before building the fully generic in spiral, we built a generic in spiral which did not include the dipole term in the stress energy tensor. So we're basically just looking at the effects of only the spin curvature force. Okay. So this was work I did in this paper here, if you're interested. The way that we did this calculation is we used oscillating geodesics in combination with near identity transformations. And the reason we did it this way is so we had a relatively fast computation of this totally general orbital trajectory, because it becomes more and more non-trivial to have a fast evaluation for more generic orbits. Okay. So is there a question? Okay, yeah. So oscillating geodesics, this is a very simple model, which you're probably very familiar with, particularly if you think a lot about orbital dynamics. This is something which has existed for a long time in describing, Keplerian orbits. But for EMRI orbits, you can basically describe each of these pieces of the trajectory as a geodesic, and then imagine that there's some small perturbing force which, shifts the trajectory, and you stitch the sequence of oscillating geodesics together to construct your trajectory. So in the case of a geodesic, you can describe, the geodesic using various collections of conserved quantities. In this case, we use, the orbital parameters, the semilattice rectum, eccentricity, and inclination, as well as the phases associated with different, features of the orbit, the radial oscillations, polar oscillations, and the spin curvature precession, essentially. So for a geodesic case, obviously, you won't have any change to the conserved quantities, and
Sorry, yeah. I assume Schwarzschild.
Say that again, sorry.
I assume a Schwarzschild black hole.
No. This is a Kerr black hole. So everything I'm talking about is fully generic. So fully generic orbital configurations, as well as, exact in the spin of the larger black hole. Does that make sense? So
for the angles, the angle variables, you have radial and so for Kerr, you have three angles.
Yeah. So because, yes, absolutely. So you do need to include that when you're constructing the waveform. When you're computing the trajectory in terms of Meno time, the only frequencies which will matter are the polar and radial, and that's just due to the killing symmetries associated with the Kerr spacetime. So the azimuthal, the phi coordinate won't play any role when you compute everything in terms of Meno time, if that makes sense. But yes, you do need to include, this is a real physical frequency that needs to be included into the waveform. But basically, if you have the trajectory in terms of the radial and polar frequencies, you can just quite trivially compute the azimuthal or the phi oscillations, if that makes sense. Okay. Yes. So as you can imagine, when you include spin curvature force, this is not so simple. You have basically a shift in these conserved quantities due to the presence of the spin curvature force, and you have a shift in the frequencies. So in this way, we piece together a spinning body trajectory. In combination with the oscillating geodesic method, we use near identity transformations, which again are a canonical sort of technique used for describing orbital dynamics in a whole host of different fields. So essentially what you see here is the dephasing in the phi coordinate. The phi phase associated with the gravitational wave. And when I say dephasing, I mean the difference between if you just have a non-spinning body and a spinning body. So like this is the amount, this is like the radians of dephasing that you accumulate due to the presence of the spin curvature force. Okay. And you'll notice that there are many, many small timescale oscillations. I think this is for like a 10 to the power of 2 mass ratio. These little oscillations don't contribute to the gravitational wave phase at the order that we care about for Emery's. So we want to average over them, so we don't have to integrate through them, and take up much more time computing the trajectory. So the perfect way to do this is using a near identity transformation, which is essentially defining a transformation that is close to the identity. So we're using the fact that these oscillations are small, and so we can define this transformation, and therefore we can define a set of equations to solve, which give you the average trajectory, and we can just isolate that long timescale secular trajectory which we want for our gravitational wave calculation. Yes, and what this does is it speeds up the evaluation of our trajectory by 2 to 5 orders of magnitude, depending on what mass ratio we're trying to compute. So this, for example, can be tens of minutes or even hours versus fractions of a second. And then we just directly use these phases as input for producing a gravitational wave signal. So let me just see how much time I've got. Okay, good. So this allowed us to compute the very first gravitational wave signal for totally generic orbital configurations, including spin curvature force effects, and sort of see how much dephasing you get through the presence of that spin curvature force. So this is just an example of a moderately eccentric, moderately inclined orbital configuration. And you can see the dephasing that occurs due to the presence of that spinning secondary. Okay. And if you want more details, they're here in this paper. Okay. All right. So in summary, I guess there are kind of two takeaways which I want, you to take away from this talk, hopefully. The black hole perturbation theory community has made enormous progress in EMRI modeling. So this is not just in spinning secondary effects. This is also in gravitational cell force. And that would be a whole other talk, which maybe many of you know about. I have focused on spinning secondary effects in my work, and I've particularly focused on looking at completely general orbital configurations, which is what we need for astrophysical sources detectable by LISA, presumably. I've also used some methods for accelerating the computation of EMRI trajectories and computing the corresponding waveforms. So this combination of the generality of the orbit, the genericness of the orbital configuration, as well as the speed of the calculation, these two features are both essential for the accurate and fast gravitational wave analysis that we need to do for EMRI modeling for LISA. So there's been significant progress towards doing the precision black hole measurement that we want to do with EMRIs when LISA flies. Okay, so maybe in the last 10 minutes or so, I'm just going to briefly talk about some future work in this field. But please interrupt me with any questions if you had any about the main portion of the talk. Okay, so I'll continue, but just shout out if you have any questions.
Maybe I'm just curious, you know, now that you're computing these secondary spin effects, you can sort of use them to tell like how well you might be able to actually measure the spin of the small object. So could you just give us sort of a clear how big these effects are?
I have not done a full detectability analysis for the spin of the secondary. So basically, I've taken the first step, which is obviously calculating the waveforms, and then what I need to do is like a full Bayesian analysis to see how detectable these effects actually are. So that's like a next step. However, you know, a benchmark that people use is kind of like 1 radian dephasing, which has it's problematic because due to, you know, degeneracies, this isn't necessarily the case that a 1 radian dephasing will be detectable. But certainly you see more than a 1 radian dephasing for spin curvature force. The issue is how big does the spin have to be? So basically the size of the secondary spin is going to be constrained by the mass ratio, because it's, you know, it's related to the mass of that secondary body. So when I say spin, I don't mean, when I say the spin is small, I don't necessarily mean the dimensionless spin is small, although that can also be true. I mean, you know, the dimensional spin is small. So we can perform perturbation theory in the dimensional spin. So this is determined by the mass of the secondary body. So the cases that I looked at were sort of like 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4. But the dephasing shouldn't really depend on the mass ratio too much. There'll be slight variations depending on exactly what your dimensionless spin is, but it'll be roughly that order of magnitude of like a 1 radian. I can give you more concrete numbers if I refer to my paper and my Mathematica notebook, but hopefully that gives you a sense.
Okay, so you're saying, if sort of the spin of the secondary is, you know, not negligible, then this effect will sort of...
Yeah, exactly. So I mean... At some point, the EMRI limit breaks down, right? Obviously. I didn't do the calculation with a very extreme mass ratio, but like these things should hold, the dephasing should hold roughly But I need to like, so one of the future things that we need to do is compute many waveforms across the entire parameter space. So for different mass ratios, for different spins, different dimensional and dimensionless spins, obviously different orbital parameters. This requires you to be able to evaluate the waveform very fast. So I've done a lot of work in evaluating the trajectory very fast. You then need to pair it with methods for computing the waveform very quickly so you can actually perform computations across the entire parameter space, rather than just having this heuristic kind of detectability estimates, which aren't really good enough. I don't know. And I can talk about that more, actually. So the one point I was going to make is that there was a detailed analysis performed by actually this person here, Gabrielle Piovano, who's a postdoc. But this was only for circular equatorial orbits with aligned spins. So this is a very special orbital configuration, and it's hard to generalize from such a special orbital configuration. So it was found that there are degeneracies in the waveform such that it's quite hard to actually detect secondary spin for this particular quite constrained case. But I think it's widely thought in the perturbation theory community that this will not hold up in general. So if you move to a more generic orbital configuration, likely due to like the precession of the spin, due to like, you know, various different qualitative effects that the secondary spin will have on the waveform, this will mean that it's detectable for EMRI waveforms. Hopefully that answers your question. I'm sorry if that was unclear. Okay, brilliant. But this is kind of an open question that we want to probe in a lot more detail, or I want to probe in a lot more detail. Sorry, I think someone was asking a question.
Yes, thank you. So regarding to this discussion, why are you choosing 10 to the minus 3 to minus 4 mass ratio? Isn't that quite high?
Yeah. So this is purely for computational convenience. But we're actually... when we say computational convenience, we can compute the trajectories for arbitrarily high or arbitrarily extreme mass ratios. We cannot, at the moment, compute waveforms quickly for arbitrarily high mass ratios. So it was just to be able to compute the waveform, you know, fairly quickly. However, this is something which is, you know, there are many tools which have been developed which should allow for us to quite straightforwardly be able to compute the waveform more quickly. We just haven't taken that next step. And we will actually compute in sort of the next version of our paper, we'll compute higher mass ratios and add those in. It's totally doable. Did that answer your question?
But my point is that this mass ratio, isn't this one too high? I mean, because if you go just to 10 to the minus 5, then your difference drops for order of magnitude, then it should be less than a radian, right? And then you cannot say that it's detectable. Also, how are you sure that for 10 to the minus 3, the not considering the self force would be still okay?
This is all the one phase rate. This is like the post adiabatic phase.
Yeah, but they are not considering the self force update. I mean, they are just considering.
So we're
considering the orbit average self force at leading order, which is the adiabatic contribution. If I don't know if that was your question or not.
So I guess the phase shift you're computing is right, so it's independent of the mass ratio because it's it's adiabatic. So that one is independent of mass ratio. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, it's just
I actually have two questions, but I'll ask at the end. So please.
Sure. No, it's no problem. Please interrupt if you want to. No, these questions have been great. Okay, I'll just quickly talk about some future plans, and then I should wrap up pretty soon. So there should be lots of time for questions. Okay. So there are sort of three main avenues which I think would be exciting to pursue, building on all of this work that's been done in the perturbation theory arena. So one of the first things, which is kind of exciting, and there have been quite a few people working on this recently, is leveraging perturbation theory in order to enhance intermediate mass ratio signals relevant to, you know, current LVK detectors as well as future ground-based gravitational wave detectors. So just to give you a little bit of background, there was, there are plenty examples in the literature I could provide showing you why perturbation theory can be powerful even beyond the regime of its formal validity. But one particular example, which I'm showing here, is work done by Barry Wardell and collaborators, which basically includes all of the self-force effects up to second order self-force that you need for like a 1PA, first post-adiabatic order Emery waveform. This is just for a Schwarzschild black hole, circular orbits, kind of the simplest possible case. But what this shows is that by, performing a simple mapping from mass ratio to like reduced mass ratio, you can obtain, using perturbation theory, something which stays in phase with numerical relativity waveforms, even at like a 1 to 10 mass ratio. So this is quite promising for leveraging perturbation theory for, other applications. Hopefully in future, we can build more generic orbital configurations and, see if this holds. We can also combine perturbation theory with numerical relativity, which has been done already by many folks to build nice surrogate models what I'm interested in is including spin effects, of course, into, surrogate type models or also informing effective one body theory, for example, using perturbation theory, which is also something which has many people have been working on recently. Okay. So the second avenue is thinking about effects which go beyond these purely general relativistic effects and thinking about the astrophysical environment around the black hole, including the accretion disk. So again, this is something which people have been thinking about more and more recently. So, it's been shown that wet Emerys might contribute significantly to the population of Emerys that we see with LISA. So when I say wet Emerys, what I mean is, an Emery that's in an accretion disk. So there are these associated gas drag effects and planetary migration effects, which will alter the trajectory of the body and hence leave an imprint on the waveform. So this is also something that needs to be thought about carefully, and it might even be a way of probing accretion disks using Emerys, as well as enabling the precision black hole property measurement that we like. Okay, so finally, this is sort of what I was talking about a little bit earlier, a moment ago. We need to accelerate the computation of all of these waveforms in order to actually do LISA data analysis, in order to perform Bayesian analysis and detectability estimates, et cetera. We need to be able to evaluate waveforms quickly across the entire parameter space. So you may have heard of the fast Emery waveform package. Anyone who works on Emerys will probably know about this. But essentially, we can use GPU acceleration and neural network interpolation tools and evaluate waveforms very quickly. So this is something I'm interested in relation to spinning secondary effects. So incorporating spinning secondary effects into the fast Emery waveform framework in order to, do the detailed studies of detectability of secondary spin, et cetera, that I want to do. Yes, and we do need this, of course, for LISA data analysis. There'll be no way that we can actually realize the potential of Emery's and perform the precision measurements that we want to perform without being able to evaluate these waveforms quickly. And that's it. That's the end of my talk. Oops, I'm going. I might just go back to the final slide. And if you have any questions, please fire away. I think we have a few more minutes left.
Maybe I'll ask my question first. So the first question is, for this general waveform model you used, did you include the linear in spin defect?
Yes. Sorry, yes. Okay. So we only went up to leading order in small body spin. So these are linear in spin effects, which means the pole-dipole form of the Matheson-Papavetrou-Dixon equations.
Very good. So the second question, for this Emery evolution, right? So the energy and the angular momentum are quantity, but for Carter constant, it's tricky. Quite not trivial to relate to flux.
Exactly.
People have been trying hard to show that. But if you include the spin-induced flux, do you still relate that to the change of color?
Yes. So, I'm not quite sure if I'm answering your question. So you can evolve spherical. Sorry, that was my email. You can evolve spherical orbital configuration. So you can have like an arbitrary eccentricity and an orbit that's constrained to be spherical. And you can just evolve this using the E and L that we computed, if that makes sense. So you can compute in spirals using the fluxes that we have. They're just not fully generic. You need the evolution of the energy, the angular momentum, and the Carter constant in order to evolve a fully generic in spiral. Exactly analogous to like the adiabatic case, for example. I don't know if that answers your question. Sorry.
Maybe I'll ask again. So let's say Emery in curl was Schwarzschild, it is shown that if you perform the orbit average, you can relate the flux at infinity to the change of Carter constant. This is a quite non-trivial result. So what I'm asking is, if you include the spin defect, does this spin relation still hold? The flux at infinity still equals to the change of...
No. If I'm understanding your question, you're asking if the evolution of the Carter constant that you use for an adiabatic waveform linking the orbit average fluxes to the evolution of the Carter constant, whether that relation holds. Not necessarily. So this is the open question which I'm kind of referring to. To my knowledge, we don't know the answer to that.
You will need that if you want to get the evolution.
Exactly. So this is something that we're working on currently, basically. If I'm understanding you correctly.
Okay.
So this is the final hurdle, basically. But it shouldn't be. There are lots of similarities between spinning body orbits at leading order in spin and geodesics. And you can often exploit these similarities and exploit how close they are to geodesics. They also have three constants of motion, exactly like a geodesic. They're just slightly different constants of motion. So a lot of the analysis, you can perform it in a similar way to the adiabatic case, for example. The calculation just needs to be done. Perhaps someone else has already done it. It's just not to my personal knowledge, if that answers your question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, in fact, that was my exact same question. Yeah. So okay. It was because you, during the talk, you hinted at the fact that the solution to this problem was near. But yeah. I guess what you're really saying is that, well, there's a hope that maybe somebody will be able to, or that you will be able to establish a flux formula for a generalized Carter constant, but you're not there yet.
Exactly. That's exactly right. When I say we're near, I mean, we have all the pieces. We need to put them together correctly. And we do not have the way of doing that yet. But I believe it shouldn't be an extremely huge task, in my personal opinion. But...
Well, I wish you good luck because, I mean, as Juan was saying, I mean, when that result came out, and I think that was Mino who derived it, that flux formula for the Carter constant, I mean, it was a considerable surprise. No one...
Exactly.
No one knew, no one felt that this might exist. So I mean, it was a miracle then. Hopefully the miracle will reapply, but, you know, good luck. Exactly. Good luck. I wish.
I'm not saying it's trivial. I'm definitely not saying it's trivial. I think we can build on Mino's work, however, like I'm saying, because there are lots of similarities between geodesics and spinning body orbits to leading order. So it should be a smaller step to take. Is what I'm saying, but I'm not saying it's non-trivial. It's definitely,
yeah, but that'd be great. I mean, that if you have that, then you have pretty much everything.
Exactly. So exactly.
That's great. Yeah.
Exactly. It's definitely hard. Any other questions? Yeah, please.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for that. I just have a practical question. So, when you say about assembly number three to accelerate the composition of waveforms, like Lisa, I feel a long time away in the future, right? So,
yeah.
Why do we need them fast today?
That's a really good question. Because we want to know which effects are actually detectable, right? So we need to perform a full Bayesian analysis across the entire parameter space to see, like, you know, are spinning secondary effects actually detectable? Will we be able to detect them with LISA? And if they're not, we don't need to include them in our waveform models, for example. We might need to include them. It's a subtle point, but, you know, this is something we want to answer before we start developing, like, production-grade waveforms for LISA, in my opinion. So you want to be able to perform, like, detailed studies of where these effects are important across parameter space. We believe that we need second order cell force, first order cell force, spinning secondary effects, all of these things. They're very computationally expensive to compute all of these things across parameter space. And it would be nice to actually know if we can measure them. And if we can measure spinning secondary effects really well, that's also a very nice thing because we can learn stuff about, like, formation channels, just as we do in LIGO. The spin orientation of the binaries tells you a lot about their history and stuff like this. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of the motivation. Yeah.
That's a short answer, and I like that. But you cannot get significant headway by just some Fisher analysis or something.
So people do that. Yeah, exactly. So people do. I mean, even for Fisher analyses, you don't want your waveform computation to be taking, you know, forever. So I think there's always an advantage to having it fast. But yes, people do Fisher analyses using slower waveforms. There are some problems with Fisher analyses. But this is definitely like a first step that you want to take to do like a preliminary detectability analysis. Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right. Yeah.
Hi, thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions?
Is that what kind of waveform that you use when you are talking about your generated waveform?
Like how we calculate it? We use a frequency domain Tucholsky method. We compute all of the fluxes and then combine them together in the frequency domain. I don't know if that answers your question or not. Do you mean the specific parameters? Or?
It's probably some Kluge waveform.
It's not Kluge. It's not Kluge. No. It's a fully relativistic waveform.
Is it fully relativistic?
Yeah. When I say fully relativistic, it is missing higher order cell force effects. We only have the leading order cell force. Right? But it's fully relativistic in terms of it's not a kludge. So we include all the effects that we do include, we include accurately and fully, if that makes sense. So I guess you could call it a kludge if you want. I mean, it's missing some pieces. It's not, it doesn't include second order cell force. It doesn't include certain aspects of, you know, first order cell force. And it doesn't include the effect due to the dipole stress tensor, even though we've calculated those fluxes. But as I mentioned, there are certain issues with bringing those in order to compute the in spiral. So the motivation for this is we don't have those calculated generically at the moment. Even, you know, the lower order pieces of cell force, it's extremely challenging to actually compute waveforms using, you know, including like first order conservative cell force, for example, just because of the computational expense. So this is something that people are working on very actively. And it's, you know, it's happening right now as we speak. And so hopefully we'll be able to piece all of these things together in order to build a complete waveform. But this would be like, you know, yeah, this is like the ultimate goal of the entire cell force program, basically, is to have these complete waveforms. It's kind of a non-trivial task, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah. My point is that I understand the relativistic waveform just for care and for
Just for her, just for the adiabatic case, or
for care. As far as I know,
I think Hassan is asking about the fast. How does it compare to the fast waveform? Yeah, I think Hassan is asking about that.
The fast waveforms are. So if you're talking about few, the so that is only adiabatic at the moment, and there is it's limited in orbital configuration. So when I say it's only adiabatic, it doesn't include higher order cell force effects, and it doesn't include any spinning secondary effects, at least like the publicly available, you know, people are obviously actively working on extending it, but the publicly available few is adiabatic, and not generic Kerr, if that answers your question. So the waveform I have here is not a fast waveform. I haven't, this guy here is a slow waveform. So in future, I want to make this fast by incorporating these effects into few. Sorry, hopefully that's clear. Sorry if that wasn't clear.
How slow is this? Just this was maybe it answers my question.
How was this calculated?
Yeah, how slow is it? I mean, how fast is it?
Oh, how fast?
Yes.
I mean, it totally depends on what, you know, what computational infrastructure you're using. For me, I used like 10 cores. I mean, you can use many more. So take this with a grain of salt, but I use like 10 cores, and it's pretty trivial to parallelize. So, because it's just basically combining all the different modes together to construct a frequency domain waveform. So for me, like depending on the mass ratio, it would take hours, minutes to hours, depending on how extreme mass ratio you want to compute. But you can get it much faster than this. Which is why people use frequency domain methods, because it's obviously easier to parallelize. Yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. Was that clear?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. No more questions. Let's thank Lisa again.
Thank you so much.